and welcome to another edition of The Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This episode, we are heading to Japan and looking at director Yasujirō Ozu and his film Late Spring. Considered one of the greatest films ever made, this film is considered a staple of Japanese cinema. Returning on the show today to talk about Late Spring is Professor Michael Giuliano. Professor Giuliano, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
So, this is interesting. This was actually the first Ozu film for me and the first time I've ever seen this film, and I actually really liked it. I came in a bit unsure. I was like, oh, I'm not sure if I'm going to like this, but I was really surprised at how much I enjoyed this.
Well, you know, I've used this film in courses that I've taught, including an upcoming course I'm doing on Japanese cinema, and for me, I think it's the perfect introduction to Ozu's work. I mean, it's on the short list of greatest Ozu films, meaning greatest films, period, and also I think it's very user-friendly in terms of a storyline and aesthetics that are really easy to grasp. I mean, not that his other work is difficult, but this is a film where all in one place, you really get the essence of Ozu. Everything that he's so good at, you see crystallized in this particular film.
For our listeners who may not know who he is, give us a little bit of background and biographical information about Ozu and his career.
Well, Ozu is a real old-timer. He's born in 1903. He begins working during the silent film period. And, you know, bear in mind that at the point where sound was coming to Hollywood in the late 20s, in Japan, they were still making silent films for technological reasons, and I would wager for cultural reasons, too. They were late coming to sound. So when Ozu made some of his major early films, like I Was Born But in 1932, that's still a silent film. By the time he makes his first sound films in the mid-30s, he's a veteran already. He's made quite a few films. During World War II, life was tough for everyone in Japan, but amazingly, the Japanese film industry continued, and not just overtly propaganda. They were making films for a domestic audience that wanted entertainment as well. Ozu kept working, and then I think really just after the war, he flowers in the late 40s and from that point onward, and an international audience discovers him. And that brings us back to Late Spring from 1949, which overtly, if glancingly, acknowledges World War II, and then also is, I think, in many ways a perfect introduction to Ozu. In fact, I've used the film in courses. I'll be using it in an upcoming course on Japanese cinema because it's really an all-in-one exposure to Ozu. You get his real strengths there, particularly his great theme or one of his great themes of balancing aspects of traditional life and modern life. And that's not always an easy balance for the characters to maintain. And I think Late Spring is one of his most user-friendly films. I think it's really, not that his other films are difficult, but this is a film where if you're not familiar with Ozu, it's a great way to get to know him.
Yeah. I think one thing I really noticed was interesting about his style was his editing. I mean, there was no use of like a traditional transitions in between scenes. It just cuts right to it. And I know a lot of people are talking about when he's going from one area to another, he does a lot of pillow shots, that are what they're called. It's like he shows shots of the surrounding area around it, and then he goes right to it, whereas you just, you know, a lot of traditional stuff, you just show one establishing shot and go right to the scene.
Well, Ozu has a deceptively simple editing strategy, and it ties into his sense of mise-en-scène. He does not do a lot of camera work by way of moving the camera or fast cuts or anything like that. He's not flashy. He's not showy. He's very straightforward, very basic. The camera oftentimes in what we would call an establishing shot really does place you at a kind of safe, neutral, middle distance where you're looking at the characters. And just as the characters are typically in a family setting seated on the floor, the camera is seated, if you will, about 3 feet above the floor. These are sometimes called tatami mat shots because the characters are seated on tatami mats. The camera is like another guest at the table, if you will. It sits quietly and observes. And there are some cutaways, and there is some flexibility there, but not a whole lot, actually. The camera just kind of takes things in a straightforward fashion. And then back to your point, when he does go from scene to scene, he really generally avoids fades, dissolves, wipes, anything like that. He usually just has a straight cut. Now, sometimes he'll cut directly from that kind of domestic scene to another domestic scene or an exterior scene, just a simple straight cut. There are times, though, where he has what are known as a kind of interlude shot. In other words, he'll go from a conversational domestic scene to a brief shot or several shots of landscape. And then from that to another domestic scene. And that in many ways functions as a kind of environmental pillowing, if you will. It kind of swaddles and you know, really kind of encapsulates what he's doing there by showing these family dramas, but giving you a sense at least of the larger urban or oftentimes natural context. And so it may just be a several seconds of looking at the landscape. And that in some ways is kind of meditative. It's like a pause between dialogue scenes. It's a quiet interlude, if you will.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that are really interesting is, you know, let's say we're talking right now, and we're going to be shooting this scene. It would be shot like from over the shoulder shot. So it'd be on my right shoulder, then your left. If that was shot in a movie, but this way he doesn't do the over-the-shoulder shots. He just gets you right, gets them right in front of the frame. And I found that really interesting, and not like what we usually see when we're seeing a conversation in a movie.
Well, you're absolutely right, and in fact, he so much avoids the typical Hollywood over-the-shoulder shot or shot reaction shot kind of format. He just totally eschews that. And what he does oftentimes is when he does take the camera in closer, and he does, even though oftentimes when a scene opens, it's a rather neutral medium shot, he will go for closer shots of characters. But when he does that, you're absolutely right, he typically has a shot where the character is speaking almost into the camera eye, certainly towards the camera. And it's a form of direct address, as if the character were presenting him herself. Now, bear in mind, the characters tend to be relatively reticent, polite, very well-mannered. In other words, they don't grandstand and make big speeches and wave their arms, but in their own quiet way, they are saying a lot, and they say it to the camera. So that's one reason why there's an intimacy to his films. On the one hand, there can be a certain neutrality because of a kind of objective look at a room or characters in a room, but then the characters do directly speak to you, and that's one reason why I think, frankly, the film speaks so directly to us.
Yeah, because I do remember, it's like, are they looking right at the camera?
They're breaking one of the cardinal rules of most filmmaking. I mean, if you've been on a film set, you know they always tell you, don't look in the camera eye. Yeah. And in Ozu's films, they come very close to doing that. They never break the fourth wall, really. There's never an instance, really, of breaking out of character or directly addressing the audience. But the effect is almost as if the character were talking just to you, one person to another person. That's part of the intimacy of getting to know these characters in a very quiet, kind of incremental way.
Yeah, I almost felt like I was watching House of Cards.
Oh, yeah, I've never heard Ozu talk about it in that context, but the language is a little cleaner in Ozu's films. But yes, I see the point there. I'm not sure he'd see it, but I see it.
And I understand this, when I was looking at it from a modern audience, you don't really see the film as being controversial, but I understand this film had to go through a lot of censorship laws at the time. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we have ourselves to blame as much as anyone in Japan, because remember, when the war ended in 1945, Japan was an occupied country, and the American occupation forces, on the one hand, wanted to impose an American-style democracy in Japan, which they did. We wrote their constitution, basically. We gave them democracy, whether they wanted it or not. And, of course, they have adapted to it very well. But in any event, on the one hand, we were encouraging free speech, because that's part of democracy. On the other hand, there was very strict censorship in Japan in the late 40s, right up through the early 50s, when the American occupation ended in, 52? And so even though the Japanese filmmakers all continued working, the films had to be vetted by American censors. So it wasn't just Japanese studios and film executives who would have been nervous about certain subject matter, but the reason they were nervous was they had American officials looking over the shoulder. And so what you'll find in Ozu's film, this film in particular, Late Spring, is references to World War II, but they're glancing. And I think all the more powerful for that, because after all, the Japanese, for obvious reasons, wanted to put the war behind them as much as anyone could possibly do so just a few years after the fact. And for instance, the daughter, Noriko, in the film, it's a father-daughter storyline. The daughter in the film is still living with her widowed father. She's a young adult. About time she moved out of the nest, but she's still in the nest and wants to stay there. One reason why she's still in the nest, and there's some more compelling reasons, but this qualifies as one, is the fact that very quickly in the film makes reference to the fact that she's a little frail, a little fragile. She was malnourished during the war. And it's a very quick reference in the film, but you realize that during the wartime itself, She would have, like many Japanese, been starving or near starving, and so that has affected her health and in some ways kind of stunted her development. Or again, this gets into armchair psychoanalysis, but reasons why she would not only still be at home but seem a little fragile at times, like that she wants to stay in the nest. It's just she really suffered at that age, particularly as a teenager or a young adult, when you need your nutrition and she wasn't getting it. Now, that's the kind of thing that could get past the censors, because it almost gets past the viewer. It goes so quickly. But when you watch the film closely, and you have to watch an Ozu film closely, it's really important to the storyline that that's one of the few direct references to World War II in a film that, after all, was released just 4 years after the war ended.
Yeah. And I did see a lot of, like, I did see a few commentary about post-World War II commentary in the film. I mean, one of the things I really noticed was when she's driving with the one guy on the bike, and you see the Coca-Cola sign. And then you also see a lot of signs all with the Japanese, original Japanese language. There's English right under that. And then, like, kids are even playing baseball. So you see, like, this Americanization, I guess, of Japan at that time.
That's a really good point. One of my favorite shots in the film is actually that one where she and the boyfriend are out on their bikes going down the road. And it's a reminder of how Ozu really, although he's associated oftentimes with these domestic dramas, indoor tatami mat shots, if you will, is really exceptional at showing you landscape when he decides to. Mm-hmm. And as they ride through the landscape on their bikes, it is a kind of opening up for her. She's out of the house. She's with a boyfriend. Maybe life is opening up. And what's opening up for her? Well, as they go along there, very prominently placed, actually, is a sign for Coca-Cola. And you realize that it's not just the American government, it's the American consumer culture that's coming into Japan. And, of course, by now, decades later, the Japanese are as American as Americans can be in terms of consumer products and awareness and all of that. And there are other places, you're right, where the signage is quite literal, where you actually will have a sign in Japanese and then the English translation right there. And that was happening very quickly in the immediate post-war period. And of course, most Japanese by this point are conversant in English. They almost had to be during the occupation. A reminder, too, that Ozu does that throughout his career. If you look at one of his greatest films, Tokyo Story, from the early 50s, there's some wonderful landscape shots, though it's an urban landscape, showing roof lines. And these are fairly traditional Japanese houses, and so they have the architecture you expect to see and would have seen for hundreds of years. But here on top of the roof, you'll see a television antenna. And Ozu likes to do that, to give you the traditional and the modern in the same shot.
Yeah, and you know, you see that Americanization in Japan, and even in Kurosawa's film, one film that stuck out to me was High and Low, and not to get too off topic, but when they're tracking the killer, and he's at this nightclub, and it's this very American-style nightclub, and they're playing rock and roll music.
Well, Kurosawa in particular was very attuned to American culture. And Ozu arguably had reservations about modernization and really, you know, had a sense of longing for a traditional life. Though it's a complicated thing to talk about. Kurosawa, I think it's less complicated in the sense that he was very receptive to American-style filmmaking and also oftentimes to modern stories that embraced or in any event sort of accepted and certainly showed modern life. Now, Ozu does that, but I think there's a more melancholic quality there, because whatever you gain from modernization, there are other things that you're losing. And that's certainly at the essence emotionally of Late Spring, in terms of a father and daughter relationship, the things you give up, but then potentially also the things that you gain.
Yeah, and I felt the film had an interesting view of marriage, because when you're watching the film, it doesn't make marriage look very appealing. A lot of the people in the film who were married are now widows. They had a wife that died or a husband that died. And I know her friend, she had a friend that was married, but I think they divorced, or no, she said she was very upset. She wouldn't like her husband if she ever saw him again. So it's interesting. It doesn't make marriage look all that appealing in the movie.
Well, not at all. You're referring to Noriko is the girl, and of course, you know, her widowed father. People have had marriages that ended through death, or in the case of Noriko's friend Aya, through divorce. Now, it's really important in the film, when we talk about modern elements, to recall that Noriko is a good girl, quote unquote. She's fairly traditional in her upbringing. She wants that. That's actually what she prefers. She refers to marriage as, quote unquote, life's graveyard. so that certainly reinforces your point. Her friend Aya is quite different. Her friend Aya is a modern girl. And the contrast between the shots of Noriko's house, where she still lives with her father, very traditional looking, and Aya's apartment, significantly an apartment where she's living as a single working woman because she's gotten divorced from her husband, and she speaks very dismissively of him. And that says a lot in a paternalistic culture, that she speaks openly against her ex-husband that way. And if you look around Aya's apartment, it has modern furniture. It has magazines, what we would call like movie magazines and, you know, contemporary culture magazines. And Aya is very modern in her outlook and certainly in her wardrobe. And these girls are friends, but you realize that, you know, the one is setting off in a very different direction from what Noriko has opted for. And Noriko is certainly perceptive. She sees all that. And she really, frankly, doesn't want that for herself. She resists that.
It's interesting, but Aya still wants her, still thinks she should get married, though. That's an interesting, even though she is considered this modern woman, she still says, well, you still need to get married.
Well, it's she's in a kind of bind here, because in a traditional culture like that, she should get married. But she knows, ironically, if she gets married, she'll have to leave the house, leave her father, leave that traditional life. And she doesn't want to do that. She wants to stay home with him. He's the one who pushes her out of the nest. He's the widower who concocts this scheme to make her think that he might get remarried, in which case she'd be like the proverbial third wheel. He's doing all, and it pains him. And when you see the look on Shishu Ryu's face, the actor playing the father, the look on his face there, he concocts this scheme to deceive his own daughter out of love. It's the kind of proverbial white lie, because he loves her so much that he wants her to get married, wants her to get out of the house. But, you know, he does and he doesn't, right? Because they have a very close connection, a tight bond. And so it's really, really one reason why it's such a great film, because it just shows the complexity and the painfulness of making decisions like this. So you're right. Noriko realizes she probably should get married, but she really doesn't want to. And she doesn't want the modern life that her friend Aya has.
That's a very powerful ending scene at the end, when the father is unpeeling the apple by himself and he just looks down and he's just, that's a very, I like almost cried at the end of that part.
Well, I have cried at the end of the film. I don't mind confessing. It's an example of how Ozu oftentimes works through indirection. In other words, you're not going to get a big speech at the end of the film where the father says, well, on the one hand this, on the other hand that. You just simply get a very quiet shot of him, you know, peeling an apple like that, and you look at his face and you read a lot into it, what he must be thinking. Very quickly, you know, the critics have picked up on this aspect of how subtle and nuanced and indirect he can be. The American critic Susan Sontag once said this about Ozu, quote, obviously there are conventions of Japanese reticence and expressiveness represented in his films. He uses discretion and ellipsis. He builds emotion by leaving things out.
One thing that I always liked about this film is the narrative. It's interesting because the groom, the big thing that, you know, she has to do, she has to find a husband and get married, we never see him. He's sort of like a MacGuffin.
Well, this is where the film is really almost devious. It's very clever this way. The focus is so tightly on a father and a daughter that even Aya, her girlfriend, is featured prominently in a few scenes, but really is a supporting player for sure. But then you have someone as seemingly important as the groom would be, right? You would think he somehow would be front and center. He's kept off camera. There's a shot in the street where you see the wedding car, if you will, and you see people, you know, festively gathered on the street. But it's so bizarre in a way, because you never really see the groom.
Never.
And this is where the director is letting us know, in effect, that, you know, this groom is almost incidental to the concerns of the story. I don't want to say it doesn't matter who the husband's going to be, but it almost doesn't.
Yeah, it doesn't.
You know what I mean? It's whatever
it's
gets there
to get
house.
The plot forward.
He's like a plot device at that point. Yeah. And very few directors would be as subtle, well, simultaneously subtle and bold as that, to actually keep. I kept looking for him in the shot, and I don't even know who the guy is.
Is Gary Cooper going to be in there?
Yeah, well, you know, it could be anyone, anywhere, right? But see, this is where Ozu is, again, such a master of telling a story in a way that is seemingly straightforward and tightly focused, but he does things like that that really are quite venturesome, quite bold in a way. And in the same way that, you know, his framing of the shots, you know, you can talk about what's in the shot, but then also what's not in the shot, what's implied, if you will.
And so I understand this film was part of his life cycle. It was called the Life Cycle Trilogy.
Well, you know, the funny thing about Ozu is it's oftentimes jokingly said that he keeps making the same film. And so I think almost every Ozu film, I mean, just look at the titles alone. Like, you know, for instance, this film features his two most famous actors, Chisho Ryu as the widowed father and Setsuko Hara as the daughter. They appear in dozens of his films, mm-hmm. and they almost always play similar roles, father-daughter type roles, or variations on that. And ironically, the Shishu Ryu, from when he was a young man, was already playing old men for Ozu. He was playing father figures. And Susuko Hara was always playing the daughter, almost mm-hmm. always like an unmarried daughter. Mm-hmm. And you know, the irony is that neither one of them in their own personal lives, the actors' lives, got married or really had families. Their characters are always dealing with these issues, but in personal life, the director Ozu never got married, and the character, the actor rather, Satsuko Hara, never got married. And let me incidentally point out that we talk about these films like they're ancient history, and yet film history is a young history. Satsuko Hara only died last fall at the age of 95, and you know, she had made her final film for Ozu around 1960-61, and she retired from the screen at that point, and she lived in seclusion with family members, and she sort of did the Japanese equivalent of a garbo. She basically disappeared, did no interviews, was essentially a private figure at that point, but went on to live for, you know, more than 50 years, in privacy that way. And when she finally died last fall, she left no survivors. She had no family left at that point. So ironically, you have an actor like Satsuko Hara and a director like Yasujiro Ozu, who are always making films about these family bonds, but they're functioning through their characters and their private lives. They're almost celibate, if I can use the word in that sense. They're really focused on making films and not really having the family life that their characters are always, if not pining for, at least thinking about. But back to your point about a cycle of films, the joke about Ozu making the same film, essentially, father-daughter pairings and variations on that, just look at the film titles. Satsuko Hara makes other films besides Late Spring for him. I mean, she appears in films with titles like, Early Summer, Late Autumn. I mean, every season gets worked on extensively and variations on it. And so the titles themselves have that similarity. The End of Summer was another film they made together. And so it is kind of smile-inducing that just as the relationships are similar in the film, the titles themselves kind of blend into each other.
Yeah, actually, I know there was a film called Early Spring. When I was looking for this film online, I had to make sure. I was like, all right, I want to get the right movie.
Yeah, you
and
want
not
Late
watch the
Spring.
Wrong.
You don't want Early Spring. Although, in some ways, it wouldn't be such a big mistake. You'd get pretty much the same story anyway.
And so, so what was the film's reception in Japan? I mean, not only did it just mean at the box office, but were film critics in Japan, did they enjoy the movie, or was it one of those films that didn't really get big until, like, in say, this 20-30 years later?
Well, no, I mean, Ozu certainly was a successful film director and a respected one. I think in many ways, though, ironically, it was Western film critics who would seize on him because they set up these two figures, and I do the same thing. I mean, when you think of Kurosawa as the most Western of Japanese directors, then Ozu becomes the most Japanese of Japanese directors. And that's how the debate in Japanese film history is being framed. That's a frame that was constructed, I would wager, by American and European film critics more than anything. But ironically, it does kind of then circle back to Japan. So now whenever they're discussed, those two directors are held up in tandem that way. And so, you know, it's almost like saying, who do you prefer? Do you prefer Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton? It's that kind of, and I always find, I say, well, look, they're both great directors.
Yeah, they're both
great. They're very different directors, technically and thematically. But do I have to pick one over the other? Mm-hmm. And so Ozu certainly has high regard that way. And again, he really just kept working in that post-war period. You know, we joke about the similar film titles and similar characterizations, but maybe because he had that sort of singular or almost celibate life there, not marrying, not having a family, he just kept making movies. And Satsuko Hara, you know, was, well, you know, there with him to do that. And also, you know, Chishu Ryu, you know, would be around through that whole final phase of his career. And of course, the funny thing there is that finally by the late 50s, Chishu Ryu was an old man. So he could play an old man very convincingly at that point. But Satsuko Hara had a kind of timeless beauty. I mean, at the point where she was getting into middle age, she still oftentimes was playing like the daughter who's not married yet. So, you know, and again, in her own life, you know, she never married and she never really had a family. So, for me, there's a large degree of really strong emotion in thinking about that when you see what her characters deal with in a film like Late Spring, to realize the actress in her personal life must have been having similar thoughts. Like, gee, I've been making all these movies tied to the seasons for Yasujiro Ozu, and I haven't gotten married yet. You know, that groom is not in the frame for me. He's not there.
And so going back to what you're saying about Kurosawa, so I was just curious, did they ever, like, you know, meet or... did they ever talk about each other anyway or anything like that?
Well, it's a good question. They certainly knew each other. I don't get any sense of close kinship or connection, which is not to in any way imply that it was the opposite of that. It's just simply they had their own careers going. And Kurosawa particularly was very strong-willed and directed and just, you know, was something unto himself. And I think you could say the same for Ozu. I mean, they had their own way of making films, and they just went, you know, sort of, I put it this way. It's like two directors at the peak of their creative powers running on parallel tracks. Now, what's interesting is there are connections between them. Setsuko Hara, for instance, we mentioned all the Ozu films she made. She also, early in Kurosawa's career, appeared in at least two of his films, No Regrets for Our Youth and The Idiot. So she actually had the experience of working for both directors, though she's much more closely connected, as she should be, with Ozu. But the Japanese film industry was small enough at that point, and the studio facilities were close enough together that it's not at all unusual to have people going back and forth, you know what I mean, from one director to another. Though the directors themselves, I wouldn't say they were bosom buddies, but they certainly would have known each other. But what I don't find much of really is, and I'll have to look a little deeper here, but I don't generally find one talking about the other. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't seem like that, and not that they avoided each other, but it doesn't seem like that was on their agenda to, and why should it be, really? You want to talk about your own work and your own concerns. You don't want to be saying, well, I'm better than he is.
Okay, so I'm getting close to the end of my questions here. Is there anything I haven't covered that you want to talk about now? Anything we haven't talked about, Late Spring or Ozu, that you want to bring up?
Well, there's still aspects of his philosophy that maybe are worth considering a bit more. The fact that he is oftentimes so neutral and yet sympathetic. The fact that the characters talk to us but don't shout at us. They talk quietly to us. The fact that oftentimes in life they're facing these major issues that we have been discussing here, and yet without a sense of melodrama. And there are certain concepts in Japanese philosophy, like mono no aware, which is an awareness of life and its transience and an acceptance of that. And the fact that the father in particular knows that there are life cycles that we all go through. Mm-hmm. And it's important to accept that and to embrace that, though not always easy to do that. And so he knows he's brought up his daughter, and very well. I mean, she's a wonderful person. But now it's time to let her go, to push her out of the nest that way. And even if he has to deceive her in a way to get her out of the nest, to get her out on her own. And she, in her own way, knows that, too. And so, again, that kind of acceptance of the cycles that we have. And that's one reason why Ozu's films oftentimes do directly acknowledge the seasons, the fact that there is a kind of seasonal clock, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, the cycle of life as well. And that's why he'll alternate, going back to what you said at the outset of our talk, he'll alternate between those shots inside a house and then have a kind of landscape interlude, maybe just for a few seconds, showing the landscape and then going back indoors. But reminders of nature, of natural rhythms and cycles, and, you know, the flowering of the trees alone will have you thinking about such things.
Okay. So last question I have for you is, I know you were talking earlier that you teach this class, or you teach this film in one of your classes, so tell us about the classes you teach.
Well, in terms of Ozu in particular, I have a course that's a survey of Asian cinema, and I've used Late Spring there. I'll be teaching a new course this fall on Japanese cinema. And I've decided, well, which Ozu film should I use? Well, it's got to be Late Spring. So I'll definitely use it there. And for Kurosawa, I'll use Rashomon, because that's a course that's going to be chronological in nature. And I want to show how Japanese cinema really took off, really excitingly took off in the late 40s and early 50s, as those great directors in particular made some of their finest films, and as the international film community really learned who they were and got the impression of them that we still have today. So really, Japanese cinema, I think, creatively is at its peak arguably in the 1950s. And here you have directors like Kurosawa and Ozu, who in the late 40s through the late 50s really make one great film after another.
Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about Japanese director Yasujiro Ozu and his film Late Spring. If you want to expand your horizons, learn more about Japanese cinema, you can't go wrong with this film. Don't forget you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m. and Sunday at 2:30 p.m. or anytime at armchairdirectors.podomatic.com. Professor Giuliano, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Oh, thanks so much. Really enjoyed it.
Oh, nice having you. For Armchair Directors, I'm Alex Baker saying so long. We will see you next week.